Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. I'm really excited for this week's episode, only because we're going to somehow balance two of the strongest polar opposite topics we could possibly have picked this week.
Yeah.
Right? Well, like, you'll see in a second, but I mean, just super serious and then like super escapist. It's
totally
something for everyone this week.
Exactly. And that is where we're going. First, this is like, that's how we do it. High culture, low culture, all of it. All right. This is what we're talking about. First up this week, it's my conversation with Iranian-American journalist Masi Alinejad. We talked to Masi not only about her ordeal of being the target of an Iranian kidnapping plot very recently, but also how she is using her platform to shine a light on the women of Afghanistan.
Then we're going to check into the White Lotus Hotel to discuss Mike White's HBO series. Did it do a good job of trying to tackle the issues it sought to address? Or do we have to speak to your manager? Sorry, I tried a hotel pun there. We're going to discuss with our TV critic, Candace Frederick. But first, Sharon, let's do some headlines.
Let's do it.
You know, I feel like every week we have to put on our genie hat and break out like some tarot cards and a crystal ball and try and figure out what is going on with the box office, especially with where the world is heading. This week is no different. So on the one hand, we have the surprise debut last week of the Ryan Reynolds video game comedy Free Guy, which took in $28.4 million at the box office, besting the $20 million projection by a mile and even outdoing the Suicide Squad from the week before. On the other hand, Sony Pictures is in the process of selling off Hotel Transylvania 4 for about $100 million. The film was scheduled to hit theaters in October with the Delta variant surging and children under the age of 12 still not eligible for the vaccine. Family films in theaters is probably a bad bet. None of this factors in things like the shrinking theatrical window, simultaneous release strategies, tons of other things. Sharon, I feel like we can ask this question every week. I'm taking your temperature. How are you feeling about the box office right now?
I'm feeling about the box office the same way I was feeling, honestly, at the beginning of COVID, which was theatricals basically, you know, dead man walking as a business. It's not bouncing back. What's coming back is some pale reflection of what the box office was for many decades as a very robust business. And so you're going to do better some weeks, like with the Ryan Reynolds
Free Guy, did really well.
And you're going to do shitty some other weeks, like despite all the money that was spent around the Suicide Squad and the massive promotion and the star-studded cast, you're going to do shitty some other weeks. I feel like, you know, this weekend there's a bunch of basically horror movies or that kind of genre opening, like three or four of them. Obviously, you're not going to be putting your family movies out there. I totally understand Sony's decision to sell Hotel Transylvania for guaranteed money to Amazon. Who's going to take their kids to the theater right now? So now we're talking about mask mandates. Well, not mask mandates, vaccine mandates in theaters. We're going to have our reporting crew in Las Vegas next week talking to theater owners for the annual CinemaCon gathering, which is where all of the theater owners gather and they see what's coming down the pike in terms of movies and they get all excited supposedly about the movies. That's the whole idea. But even that's going to be a very awkward gathering. So I don't see great things going forward for the theatrical business. What do you think?
Yeah, I think one of the big differences between Free Guy and Suicide Squad was that Suicide Squad was available on HBO Max for no added cost. So I'm sure I'm sure the theater owners would point to Free Guy and be like, see what happens when you don't put a movie out there for free somewhere else. But yeah, I mean, it's a depressing statement when you say you think the same thing now that you thought a year ago or more about the box office.
Because I'm just talking very macro. Like, in other words, 100%. If you sort of step back and look at the arc, yes, will you do better perhaps if you have a highly promoted movie that's not available on your streaming service for free? Sure. Will you do better financially overall if you have paid VOD on that streaming service, if it's some big movie like Black Widow while it's in theaters? Sure. That doesn't help the theater owners, though, when $50 million or $60 million is going to the streaming side of things. What happens when you have it available only in theaters? Well, maybe you get a small bump. But overall, if you look at the trend, it's just some fraction of what the overall box office number has been, $11 billion a year, $10 billion a year for many, many years, constantly going up a little bit. So that's all. I'm just sort of talking about like the bigger trend that you're looking at. And will it come back to that? It doesn't feel that way.
Feels further off than it should at this point. Right. That's the sad
exactly.
thing.
All right, on to television. Jeopardy. Jeopardy, the quiz show with all the answers, you wrote that, that's very good, needs to come up with a good one pronto to justify the hiring of executive producer Mike Richards as the show's new host, replacing the much regretted Alex Trebek. The latest past incident Richard finds himself apologizing for is an old podcast that he did in which he repeatedly used offensive language and disparaged women's bodies. You guys think this stuff was not being recorded at the time? I don't know. Earlier this month, you may remember Richards had to issue an apology after previous allegations of misconduct resurfaced once it became clear he was going to land the gig. Jeopardy does begin its taping, its new season this week. So the die is cast at this point. It's this guy, along with Mayim Bialik for some specials. Daniel, how did they screw this up so badly? We were all so excited about the new Jeopardy host, it seems like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, to not have vetted him properly is a huge mistake. You know, it's weird how much we revere this position, but we do. And the host of Jeopardy should be unapproachable. It should, or whatever the butchering that word, but he should be beyond reproach.
Beyond reproach is what
yes,
you mean.
Yes, it should be. I mean, Alex Trebek was like, who didn't like Alex Trebek? Right. He was this great guy. He was the Tom Hanks of game shows. For that, I like that analogy. And this guy is not that at all. And it just seems like, to your point, they had all this goodwill. They had all this momentum. Everyone was interested to see the different guest hosts each week, who would get the job. And when it turns out to be the guy who was doing the picking to begin with, or at least certainly involved with it, makes the whole thing seem like it was a shill. It ruins all this goodwill. And Jeopardy has a very unique position. Like these daily shows, we sort of laugh them off as like these little syndicated shows, Jeopardy, whatever. They're in our homes every single day, yeah, every night right. of the week, all that's year right. long. It's a special relationship you have with these people. It's like a local news anchor, but for all of us. And
I mean, so do you think
it's unbelievable?
Do you think it's like tainted from the jump, like this guy?
We'll see. I think people do forget and people do forgive, I guess. I think, you know, if they just sort of like put the blinders on and just go forward, after a little bit, people will be like, okay, he's good at the job. I like Jeopardy. I'm not going to stop watching because of him. Mm-hmm. I think that's their best
bet. It's
time
to watch all these shows. I don't get it, but anyway.
My wife and I watch Jeopardy every day, except we've been so busy the last few months that we're like 2 months behind. So we record it every day. So I'm like behind on my guest hosts. I've like sampled a few that I've missed.
Okay, spoiler, LeVar Burton didn't get it.
He did not get it. He was not good. I watched one of his episodes and I read a lot about him.
He didn't have good ratings.
Well, he didn't have good ratings. All the ratings have gone down week over week, but he was just kind of clumsy and he was a little hesitant and he didn't have the flow of it down. I mean, it was only 1 week, but yeah, no, he was not great. And I think what's also interesting is now you're putting Mayim Bialik on there to compare her to. And it seems like that seems like an odd thing to do to Mike Richards at the same time, to basically, you know, kind of share the stage a little bit with the second choice, maybe. I don't know. The whole thing is just so
weird. Do you think
it
was like the fix was in for this guy to begin with?
It feels that way, right? I mean, everyone was making the the Dick Cheney joke that he basically just like chose himself for the job. You know, did Ken Jennings turn it down? I don't know. He seemed like, I think everyone thought he was going to be the one. It's amazing that they did such a poor job in this day and age of vetting him. And it was really funny yesterday, on Wednesday, The Ringer did this story that resurfaced these podcast allegations, and The Ringer called Sony for comments like, hey, what do you think about these things? And like, while they were waiting for their comment back, they deleted all the podcast episodes. So it's like,
just like, we whoops.
I don't understand how people screw this up nowadays.
Yeah.
The internet is written in pen, as Mark Zuckerberg said in social network. Actually, it was his girlfriend. Anyway. All right. Finally, this week, Sharon, let's talk about something we're both super excited about. The Wrap's annual event, The Grill. The two-day live event focuses on the convergence between entertainment, media, and technology. It's a topic that probably felt niche when you launched The Grill over a decade ago, but now it's essential, right? Like, who doesn't talk about this stuff? Sharon, what can you tell our listeners about this year's event?
Yeah, I think we're going into the 12th year of The Grill, if I'm not mistaken. So we've really been doing this a long time. Started out with Jeff Weiner from LinkedIn and Dick Costolo from Twitter at the time. It was very new and groundbreaking.
Was Tom from MySpace there?
Yeah, exactly. we were probably trying to get him. MySpace is a social media company, for those who don't remember. Anyway, and now tech runs everything, doesn't it? Every single year, there's really interesting, innovative companies. We just had a long conversation this morning with a new analytics company that analyzes and delivers streaming data that you can't really get otherwise. It seems to be, if they succeed, they'll be the heir to Nielsen, which is under lots of pressure in the age of streaming and even linear television. People are not happy with Nielsen. But we've got some amazing speakers lined up this year. We're going to be talking, some of those who we've announced, we'll be talking about M&A and all the consolidation that's happening across entertainment. So we'll have Kevin Mayer and Tom Staggs, who used to be the top executives at Disney, both of whom were in the running to become CEO, didn't get the gig, and then went off to do other things. Now they're working together and looking to buy up companies and basically IPO them, take them public through this mechanism called a SPAC. They just did the Hello Sunshine deal, yep, in which they got a $900 million valuation for Reese Witherspoon's company, Hello Sunshine. So they're coming. Jeff Sagansky, who's one of the originators of the SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company, financial model, along with a leading entertainment lawyer, Faiza Saeed, who will be joining us. We just also announced that Scott Stuber, the head of global film at Netflix, will be doing a keynote interview with us this year. Scott's never been at The Grill before. We've had Ted Sarandos a couple of times, so we're really excited to get to grill him. I've known Scott for a long time, back when he was running Universal Film, and it'll be very interesting to see how he has seen the film landscape change. And now he's making so many more films. The volume is just crazy over Netflix compared to what he used to have to produce every year at Universal. So, you know, Netflix really has a much easier time right now. It's really interesting to think about, where they have a single model. You pay them a subscription fee, you log onto their platform, and you watch what you want to watch. That's so much less complicated than if you're at Disney and you have Disney Plus, and you have Hulu, and you have theaters, and you have theme parks, and you have merchandising, and you have television, and you have Hulu, and you have ABC News. It's really like completely dizzying, and to figure out what content goes where. You know, Netflix is actually so much of a simpler approach. Sorry, picking that up. Netflix has a much simpler model, even though it's as big as it is. So it's going to be really interesting to talk to Scott about how he sees. And of course, we know that Netflix's streaming market share has declined significantly in the past year because of all this competition that started. So how's he dealing with that? But in addition to that, we're going to be talking about data, using data in the service of marketing and entertainment. We're going to be talking about diversity and inclusion. We're going to be talking about gaming. I can't reveal who are the head of gaming companies who are coming, but there are some. There's going to be a spotlight interview with talent, which you can't reveal what that is yet. So it's always a really interesting and dynamic conversation it will be this year because there's just so much change. So that's it. If you want to go, anybody can go. I thought you were about to ask me that, Daniel.
Thank you for mentioning that. I was about to jump in too if you needed me, but you got it.
Yeah, well, we probably will grab you at some point. So in order to attend the grill, it's part of the Wrap Pro membership. And Pro, of course, is our insider community where you get high-level, deep coverage of the industry and live events like this. This is the biggest one that we do. So go on to, what is it, Daniel? Therap.com/pro?
So yes, you can go to therap.com/join to sign up for Pro. To get more information about this year's grill event, yeah, you can go to therap.com/the-grill-2021.
See, I'd rather just go to therap.com/pro myself, but sure, you do you.
All right. As always, we like to end this first little segment with something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she's particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something she's a little more riled up about, upset about, angry, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you. All right. This week, my Wax On has to go to the women of Afghanistan. They have shown up and expressed themselves in ways that we haven't seen because we haven't been paying attention. But it turns out that over the past 20 years, women in Afghanistan have really been stepping forward into their power and participating in life in ways that wouldn't have been possible without the encouragement and the requirement that the United States brought to the government in Kabul that women's rights be front and center. They've been getting educated. They've been participating in the cabinet of the government. They've been participating as lawyers, as doctors, as journalists. Now that the Taliban has arrived with great force and great speed, these women are really terrified, as you will hear later in the podcast, in my conversation with Masih Alinejad. But what's amazing is that, you know, they've not been invisible at all. They've been very much participating in public life, and they are pushing back on the Taliban. You're seeing them now in the streets. I saw one video this morning of a woman actually leading an anti-Taliban protest of men. These women are incredibly brave. I hope that we can support them, speak out on their behalf, because we do not want to see them disappear behind some veil of a burqa going forward, which I think many of us fear is what could happen to them or is likely to happen to them with the Taliban in control of the country. That's my Wax On. My Wax Off is much more prosaic. I just got to say, Sony, you could have done a better job on figuring out Jeopardy. You have this amazing franchise. You did a great job of ginning up great excitement and leveraging that when Alex Trebek, who's beloved, passed away, bringing on all of these guest hosts and everybody getting excited and talking about a many decades old daytime contest game show. That's pretty good that you got that going. And then to have this all fall apart by naming this guy, Mike Richards, who is a behind the scenes character who really kind of looks like central casting from 1950 and who turns out to have made all these acceptable comments about women that apparently you didn't know about. Like, come on, you guys should do better than that. That's my Wax Off.
All right, when we come back, we have Sharon's interview with Masih Alinejad, and we're going to go and talk all things White Lotus with the Wrap's Candace Frederick. Stick around.
Masih Alinejad is a leading voice for women's rights in Iran and lately in Afghanistan as well. An advocate for women's freedom of choice and a persistent thorn in the side of the Tehran government, Alinejad was recently told of a plot by the government to kidnap her from the United States, where she lives in exile. But that was weeks ago. Today, she is a critical platform for Afghan women who are desperate for support since the Taliban took over the country last weekend. Welcome to you, Masih.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for all you're doing. Can you just tell us what are you hearing from Afghan women right now?
I cannot even describe how I feel, because when I talk to them, to every single woman from Afghanistan, I cry with them. You know, they are full of pain and anger at the same time. They are furious.
Do you mean at us, at the United States?
I'm going to be honest with you. Yes, they are. Mm. Actually, one of the women told me that I'm disgusted. And I was like, so I'm going to do interview with different media. Would you be happy to talk to the media? And she was just saying that, you kidding me? I cannot even like look at through my window to the streets. When I see Taliban walking past in the streets, it just gives me like goosebumps. And I cannot believe that I'm watching this. And this is a woman, actually, she's a single mother. She was so brave. She was working, like, so happy. And she was the one, actually, when I interviewed her before, telling me that now we have freedom in Afghanistan. At least I can wear my flower in my hair and I can go in public. Mm-hmm. But now they lost all their freedom overnight.
Well, I think they're getting, what we're seeing is, or hearing, is these mixed messages that the Taliban have been trying to say, oh, no, it's going to be fine. Women will have rights, or they can go to school. We're not stupid. We understand it's the Taliban, but the women don't believe this. Is that basically what you're hearing?
Exactly. Let me tell you something. We, the women of Iran, have seen this movie before.
Yeah.
24 years ago, when Ruhollah Khomeini was trying to take to actually take over Iran, was trying to go to take the power, he was exactly saying the same thing that Taliban is saying right now to the Western media. Ruhollah Khomeini was saying that we are going to give any kind of freedom to women, but in the framework of Sharia laws. So you hear the word "but." Right. This is exactly the same Zabihullah Mujahideen saying to the CNN, to Reuters, that of course women are free, but in the framework of Sharia laws. And we have experienced Sharia laws for 42 years. First, the regime come and just erased the posters of women, pictures of women from billboards, beauty salons, in the streets. Then they come after women, and they're going to erase women from public space. Look, for 40 years, we, the women of Iran, according to the Sharia law, we are not allowed to enter a stadium. We are not allowed to choose what we want to wear. We are not allowed.
I'm going to go back and repeat that, because I think people probably wouldn't understand. Enter a stadium, meaning a sports stadium.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, it's not even logical. But anyway, yeah.
It doesn't even make sense. But this is the reality of Sharia laws in Iran. And I want to tell you something.
You show me where in the Quran it says that women can't go into a sports stadium. I'm sure there's a surah that says that somewhere. But anyway.
But this is what Taliban, the Islamic Republic, and ISIS is using against women. And that is why we, the women of the Middle East, trying to say that politics should be separated from religion. Yeah. Then if you have any kind of interpretation of your religion, it's your business. Don't bring it to our personal life.
I want to ask you, so where I started sort of being into your Twitter feed, because you're so active on Twitter, and I don't really know, is Farsi close enough to the Afghan language that you're able to speak to?
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. They speak Pashto, they speak Persian. Some of them, they were born in Iran. We have same language. We understand each other.
I see. Okay. Because I wasn't sure about that. So you were, there was actually, you posted a video of a young woman. She looked very, very young and she was crying. And it was really just herself, a video confession of, as the Taliban was taking over last Saturday and Sunday, barely a week ago, it's so hard to believe how much has happened in that time. She was just pouring her heart out in this video and crying and saying, we are now going to be swallowed by history. It was so heartbreaking and seemed like just a cry from the heart of somebody like, is anyone listening to me? And that video got you know, many, many tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of views. I don't know. And then you went and you found her and you interviewed her. So it turns out that young woman is actually not in Afghanistan, but she was speaking on behalf of her friends, right?
Yeah, that video got 2 million views. And oh, that was not only her crying. That was the tears of women of Afghanistan. Yeah. I am now being in touch with many women within the society. And I got bombarded by receiving videos from women of Afghanistan. One of them is a well-known athlete. The other one is a well-known activist. The other one is a journalist. And these women are not criminal, but now I have to blur their faces because of their safety. And I'm worried that... So these women are crying as well, but they are now speaking out, speaking up against Taliban. One of the women actually told me that I live in Afghanistan. I know this is a this is risk for me. This is dangerous for me, but I have to fight for my dignity. And another woman actually told me while I was making a video of myself speaking up against Taliban, my mom said that, so you don't think about me? If they come to you, if they do something to do, what I'm going to do? And I told my mom, I'm fighting for you and for myself. Mm. It just gives me goosebumps. Another woman, a women's rights activist, she is my hero. She was crying and she said that, I cannot believe that my Kabul is gone overnight and I got older, like 30 years older, only in one night by watching Taliban in the street, and I'm scared of going out in public. So that is why these women are furious, and they're saying that now the whole Western countries are just watching us. They're expecting some actions rather than...
Let's break that down a little bit when you say that the women are furious, because I think many of our listeners might not understand. It's not, we didn't run the country. It wasn't our country. Why aren't they furious? I would imagine some people are saying with their own government that abandoned them or their own military that declined to defend them against.
That's true.
Taliban.
They are angry with their own government. They are angry with their president who left them behind. They are angry with. But the thing is, those people are not like stupid who are trying actually to escape from Taliban and begging American government that even American soldier to help them because America gave them hope. You know, for 20 years, these people build up democracy. They build up their own careers. One of them is a young model in Afghanistan in saying that I cannot believe now I am like a criminal. If I go out, they either, you know, they take me and marry me by force, kind of raping, or they kill me. And that's true.
You do think that that will happen again, even with the eyes of the world on the Taliban? They're looking for legitimacy. They're looking to be recognized in the eyes of the international community. I'm sorry.
No, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. Many women actually telling us that right now Taliban is trying to convince the rest of the world that we have changed. But look at even CNN, the reporter from CNN, from the beginning.
Clarissa Ward.
Exactly. Yep. She's doing an amazing job from the beginning. She said that these people are chanting death to America. They seem friendly. But today she reported that they were flogging people in the streets. They were actually attacking her in the street. So I'm glad that even the world seeing that what Taliban has doing to her in front of the camera, then imagine what Taliban is going to do to the people, the women and young girl when the camera is not there. Yeah. So this is what exactly the Islamic Republic has done. When they see Western media, they try to justify themselves. They try to give a good perspective, a good image of their regime. But behind the scene, what's going on? And that is why I'm saying that right now, this is the right time, because now women are using their camera, they're speaking up against Taliban, and they're calling the rest of the world and saying that this is the right time, because Taliban actually now needs to convince the rest of the world that we are doing a great job. We are not going to beaten up women, but ask them a simple question. Are these women going to be allowed to sing, to dance, to go to school, to go to university, to practice to be their true self? No, because Sharia law shows you in Iran, in 21st century. Yes, we have a smiley foreign minister using CNN, using Washington Post, New York Times, saying that we have election in Iran. But what's going on in Iran? In 21st century, as a woman, if you show your hair in public, walking in veil, you get lashes. A woman in Iran called Saba Kordafshari got arrested and she received 24 years prison sentence just because of protesting against compulsory hijab. You get lashes if you drink alcohol.
This has been your cause for many years, and you have led the way for so many women in Iran who don't have a voice and who yearn to have freedom of choice and freedom of expression. And this is how I met you originally. You wrote a book about a best-selling book, really good. I recommend it. Remind me the name of the book?
The Wind in My Hair.
The Wind in My Hair. Yeah, which is a beautiful title, and it's about Masih's journey and from being a journalist in Iran and having to come into exile. And your story is so extraordinary. And you must feel like, you want to pinch yourself at how could this be happening in another country to
it's
other
like
women.
We're watching the history is being
repeat
repeated.
Itself. Yeah. So what can we do, those of us who believe in women's rights and men and women in the United States everywhere, would like, if we can do anything, what would you recommend?
First of all, do not believe that Taliban has changed. Indeed, Taliban has changed, but they became more sophisticated of using social media and Western media to spread their lies across the world. Mm-hmm. This is the only thing that I can say they have changed, indeed. But most important than this, I want to share my own experience. For years and years, we are trying to convince the Western feminists that compulsory hijab is not part of our culture. Being lashed for drinking alcohol is not part of our culture. Right? We are being humiliated according to Sharia laws. If we sing solo, we get arrested. If we dance, we get arrested in Iran. So what makes me concerned that for a while, everything is going on in Afghanistan are going to be forgotten, and people are going to say that this is their culture. Or maybe they say that, look, I'm going to tell you something. Taliban is not going to it's not going to kill people in the street. You think that they're going to show a better image of themselves, but I am going to make sure, I'm going to tell the rest of the world that be sure they are going to execute people according to law. They are going to flog people according, like lashing people according to
the
law.
So again, what we can do, and I hear, and I do feel, and I've written that we bear some responsibility to the women, certainly to the women of Afghanistan, even as I understand, as a foreign policy matter, it's a very difficult place for the United States to be because it's a losing battle over the long term. And it's something, what's funny to me is, you and I met when you came and spoke at one of our events, and there was a foreign policy expert who was a woman who happened to be in the same foreign policy think tank as Anthony Blinken, who is today the Secretary of State. They were colleagues at that think tank, and you challenged her at that event and said, when you come to the Middle East and you bend to whatever the cultural norms are for women, you're signaling that's okay, right?
That's okay.
To the other women there, it's symbolically, it's very important. What can we do both materially and symbolically to show support for women in Afghanistan?
First of all, you have to be strong and criticizing loudly President Biden. I remember when President Trump abandoned the Kurdish fighters against ISIS in Syria, I was loud enough to criticize him. And this is a betrayal right now. My heart, I cannot sleep when I think about the women of Afghanistan. Ariana Said was one of the women who sang in a stadium in Afghanistan 6 years ago in the same stadium when woman was executed by Taliban. And now she was forced to leave the country. She's heartbroken. Millions of other women in Afghanistan, they are heartbroken. You have to be loud and clear criticizing Biden administration. and ask them to take an action and help the women of Afghanistan. If we don't need empty words. And what I want all the feminists, global feminist movement, this is the right time. If you really care about women's rights and human rights, women of Afghanistan are like women of suffragists. They are like Rosa Parks. They are resisting now. Some of them took to the streets, risking their lives.
Yes, there's video today of a woman leading a protest of men in Kabul.
Yes, exactly. They want to be heard. And do not look for moderate Taliban or conservative Taliban. Taliban means the biggest enemy of women. They're going to lash at women. They're going to kill women. They're going to execute women. They're going to rape women. And the history will judge us if we keep silent or wrongly looking for moderate Taliban or reformist Taliban. This is what we have been experiencing for 40 years. While we're saying that our government, it doesn't matter, they are reformist, conservative, or moderate. They don't allow women to be their true self. Some Western feminists say that, this is your culture. We don't want to interfere in internal matters. Right. I want to tell you that human rights is a global issue and everybody has responsibility to talk about it. If not, then you're helping the oppressors. You're helping terrorists and Islamists to put more pressure on women in the region.
Thank you. I want to take a moment and turn to your own safety because it's only a half a minute ago that you learned that there was a plot by the Iranian government to, and I know I sound like we're telling the plot of a Hollywood movie, but this is the reality. There was a plot to send secret agents to kidnap you, to smuggle you out of the country, and to remand you to Iran to who knows what fate. Luckily, intelligence found out about it, and the plot was foiled. How are you doing?
I have to be strong. You know, I'm not saying that I'm not scared, but this is the goal of the Islamic Republic. They want us, the women, live in fear and paranoia. I want to focus on my job. I'm not a criminal, you know. I'm just giving voice to voiceless people. And when I see that women in Iran risking their lives, women of Afghanistan risking their lives and sending videos to me, I want to use my freedom of speech in the United States of America and give them a voice. And that is why I ask the government in the US that this is not about me. This is about my job. This is about journalism. This is about national security. This is about Americans. The government, the regime, actually challenging the US authorities on US soil. And if you don't
find- it certainly says how threatened the Iranian government feels by you. My perspective was that I felt strongly and still feel strongly that because the United States did not take action in the wake of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, that this encourages other rogue regimes to feel that they can get away with outrageous acts towards people who speak out against them. And so I have been very angry at our government for not doing anything. We still haven't, by the way.
Unfortunately, I have to say that dictators are more united than freedom fighters. Look at the world. Everywhere, from China to Russia to Turkey to everywhere, dictators are united. But when it comes to human rights, even in America, human rights get lost in political agenda. But in my opinion, human rights should be bipartisan. Doesn't matter who is in power. If you are a true feminist, if you are a true human rights activist, if you are a true freedom fighter, you have to care about human rights, human dignity everywhere. You know, whether it happened to Jamal Khashoggi or happened to Iranian journalists. I remember some of you maybe in the West think that this is like Hollywood movie that the regime were trying to kidnap an American citizen. Yes, they did. The regime actually kidnapped Iranian journalist Ruhollah Zam from France to Iraq and from Iraq to Iran, and they executed him in front of the eyes of the rest of the world.
And this, was back in the 1990s?
Exactly. No. This is 2 years ago.
Oh, 2 years ago.
This is two years ago.
Okay, I didn't.
And right now that I'm talking to you, U.S. citizen, British citizen, Swedish citizen, German citizen, French citizen are in Iranian prison. They are like hostage because the regime are using them like bargaining chip. What I want is this. The U.S. government should ask its own allies, the European countries, at least stand up for your own citizens if you don't care about Iranian or Afghanian people.
Mm. Well, I know we're out of time, but Masi, I just want to say I'm so grateful that you're safe. Please stay safe. And thank you for the work that you're doing and the voices that you're bringing forward, because it's not easy for us to hear what's really happening. And I suspect it will get harder and not easier to know what's going on inside Afghanistan. So thank you for your work and all strength to you in continuing it.
Thank you so much for having me. I have to say that I'm not going to give up my fight. The government is more scared than me. So I'm going to keep fighting against all the extremists.
Thank you. Thank you, Masi.
Thank you.
So we really need to talk about White Lotus and that crazy ass finale. The show, written and directed by Mike White of School of Rock fame, is a fun, made-for-summer limited series about a bunch of rich white people on vacation in Hawaii and the people who cater to them. At a deeper level, it is both a critique and a send-up of colonialism, classicism, racism, and what white people say about white privilege when other people aren't looking. Candace Frederick reviewed the show for The Wrap, and she has a lot of thoughts about it, as have many people online who either find the show brilliant or fatally flawed, an example of one white guy's tunnel vision. We are delighted to have her on The Wrap-Up to talk about it. Welcome to you, Candace.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you praised the performances in White Lotus. You wrote in your review, quote, "It's a great cast, marvelous even." But then you asked, is the show, quote, "really poking fun at its wealthy characters, or are they cautionary tales about privilege and whiteness? The show seems to merely present its characters without having them reckon with their thoughts and behavior. None of them really learns anything, and maybe that's the point." Mm-hmm. So I'd love you to expand on that. And I've seen you tweet through the week about the show, like it's still on your mind. It's like stuck with you, like a lot of us. And there seems to be something about the show that's like gotten to you in some way. And I'd love to sort of hear your take on that.
I haven't seen the show in a couple of weeks when I was writing that review, and I watched it kind of all in a binge. I was really struck by the almost unanimously positive response. And I think that's what I'm mostly responding to now, that there wasn't really any, up until very recently, of people actually criticizing what I think is fairly obvious, what I wrote in that review. But I will say that from during the duration of the actually when the show was on air, so this is all leading up to the finale, I would say at the finale, that's when I started seeing a bit more critical responses. And so that's why I've been responding a little bit more aggressively this week, because I feel like I'm now engaging with other people who are kind of on my wavelength.
But let's get to the heart of it. Like, what's at the heart of what your criticism is and those of other people that you're seeing online?
I think there's such a pleasantness in terms of, or a totally just like a sense of just they're totally fine with how indifferent the characters are, as well as how indifferent the story and the storyteller seem to be about the themes in which they're supposedly criticizing, satirizing, interrogating. I just feel like none of that is really happening. None of that is really coming across very effectively. I just thought I maintain that it's very entertaining. I think Jennifer Coolidge is as phenomenal as everyone else has said, but I also think that the show has a huge blind spot in how it is very it paints the people that it's satirizing as protagonists as well. And the people who, and there's obviously a reflection of the history of colonization in Hawaii and the history in which people are, natives are still being treated and by people who look like the protagonists that we love and think are so cool. It's just, it doesn't seem to engage in a lot of those topics. It just kind of acknowledges things and just is like, okay, well, that happened. Wasn't that fun? And the show ends. it doesn't really challenge the audience. And I think that that's one of the things.
You think it kind of lets us off the hook, like nods to the fact that, oh, this guy Kai, right, who's the Hawaiian young man who has an affair with the girlfriend and she kind of pushes him. Oh, by the way, I should have said this before. There's going to be a lot of spoilers in this conversation. So if you haven't watched White Lotus yet, please go watch it because everybody else has. Okay. So so to go back to Kai, who's this very sweet character, this Hawaiian guy who works at the hotel, who gets goaded into stealing the Mossbaggers family's jewelry, and then he gets caught and we never see him. He just is like disappears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, it's weird. He seems to be the only character in the show who faced any consequences, and we didn't even see them happen. It was just all happened off screen. I thought that was really odd.
It was really odd. And I feel like we didn't really get to know him very much outside of his feelings on colonization, which I feel like is extremely single dimensional, one dimensional.
And I think Mike White acknowledged that. There was an interview that I read in Vulture where Mike White said there might have been some production issue where they couldn't go back to Kai for COVID reasons. The whole show was a creation out of COVID that HBO called Mike White up and said, "What you got?" Basically, like, what could you write and what could we do in a contained space in COVID? And this is what he came up with, which pretty damn good. I mean, I think it's the best thing Mike's done in many years, and I am a big fan of his. I do think. You know, I absolutely take your point about it being very shallow in a way, right? That we're acknowledging these big, big issues. But I do think it's possible that is, as you raise in your review too, that is kind of Mike White's point. It's like a shrug to, hey, the rich people win out. The people who have the power are going to have the power. And that is his commentary. It's not a very positive commentary, and it doesn't mean that necessarily, you know, we don't care what happens to Natasha Rockwell's character, who is like kind of Mother Earth in a way in the show. She's so good. Like, I know Natasha Rockwell is this like wacky comedy person, and she's just so like understated in this performance. It's like very beautiful. There's lots of great, great performances, I think, in the show. Notably, of course, this guy I never heard of, who's the hotel manager. Remind Murray me his Bartlett. Name.
Murray Bartlett.
Yes. Murray Bartlett. Wow. I thought that guy was so good.
Yeah.
But that is the point in some way, that it's not very inspiring, but.
Yeah. I love bleakness. I love the idea of show, like reflecting our reality. But I don't think that the show actually has any commentary. I think it's strictly reflection. And I don't think I go back to, it doesn't challenge the viewers, and I don't think it challenges its characters. And I do think that, as shallow as it is, I think that Steve Zahn's character is the only one who feels some sense of something is amiss with this character, or something is amiss with, I mean, I think he acknowledges that he's like adjacent to his flaws. I don't think he actually acknowledges that he has flaws. But it's also very unfulfilling. It's just kind of, you know, showing these rich white people just like marginally interacting with some of their flaws, but not actually confronting any
of them. Not having to deal with them, really.
Yeah. Right.
It's so funny you say that, because we're interviewing Steve Zahn right now. Like literally right now. And so I'd be very curious to hear what he has to say about sort of the interior of his character.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot there also. I mean, he has some of the most interesting lines where he's talking about, well, first of all, confessing to this sort of second tier status to his wife and this feeling of impotence and actual impotence that seems somehow emblematic of the predicament of the enlightened white man today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm drawn to his character just for the silliness of it, I think. And I think his performance is really good in it. It's a complex performance of a very simple character, I say. I don't have anything else to add to Steve Zahn's performance or that character, but I'm really just genuinely in awe of the overwhelming praise. But, you know, again, I think that there was Mitchell Kuga who wrote the piece in Vox about really the way in which the show engages with Hawaiian history and Hawaiian contemporary Hawaii.
It says like they got it wrong.
They got it wrong, but I think little less simple that I think that it was really engaging with it was not engaging with everything that I think that this show could have engaged with in terms of Hawaiian colonization. And it's not even just Kai who is deeply marginalized in this story, in a story that's already marginalized in characters like him, but it's also Lonnie who's introduced in like the first episode and disappeared.
I've never seen.
This no idea Hawaiian woman on the staff in the hotel.
It's
who has a baby.
She has a baby in that episode. I don't even remember if we even saw the baby, but it's just like they get sucked into the ocean or something. I don't know what happens to them. It's very, very odd that you seem to be marginally aware of the treatment of Hawaiian culture by specifically rich white Americans. And then you just kind of, they just evaporate. You know, the Native Hawaiians evaporate in the story. And it's very odd to me. I also thought it was really, and I know Mike White wrote this by himself.
Which
kind of says a lot. I mean, one, that he's a good writer, but also I think this shows some of his blind spots quite a bit. And I think, you know, Brittany O'Grady, who plays Pam,
Paula,
that's right.
Yeah.
Who Brittany O'Grady is actually half black. So I don't know what character she's playing or what her race is supposed to be in it, but that was what was, that was,
so she's just to say for viewers. So she's the best friend. She's the friend of the Mossbacker family who comes along for the ride.
Yeah. It was clear to me that there was just a lack of authenticity when it came to that particular character. It was just like, I just don't see anyone who is, I mean, obviously she has, she is adjacent to white privilege and maybe has some of it of embedded in her own identity. But I don't see her doing what she did to Kai in that way. I mean, it was such a naive thing to suggest. And frankly, an AE for him to do, but it was none of that really made sense. And I think it culminated in him just like, you know, like Daniel was saying, he just kind of disappeared and we never really see the repercussions that he even faces. I mean, I'm sure they were severe, but
he probably went to jail, you think,
or worse. Yeah. So I don't, it was not, it wasn't, although it wasn't as, what's it called? It wasn't as pristine as I think a lot of other people felt it was.
Yeah. I mean, I saw online, certainly after the finale, and again, right, like I've been up front, I'm a fan of the show, but, you know, I absolutely see your points that you're talking about. Some of the stuff that I observed online was, you know, a lot of anger on behalf of Belinda, who's Natasha Rothwell's character, that she didn't get her chance to have a business, you know, her own business, which is what Jennifer Coolidge was like leading her along to think that she would get, again, this thing that we've talked about that Kai, you know, we don't know what happens to him. We don't see him even in handcuffs. We don't see him at all. Mm-hmm. And then sort of this crazy outcome for Armand, you know, the hotel manager who's, you know, we just watch him descend descend until we find out, spoiler, he's in the coffin. And then, and you know, this super privileged waspy guy who's the most, you know, obnoxious, I want to say sort of the apotheosis of the obnoxious rich kid, who is the one who sticks the knife in Murray Bartlett. I mean, that has its own, you know, there's a great deal of symbolism in that to me, that I think that there was a great tweet or a piece that I saw by Jen Chaney, in which she said that Sunday night's finale was at its core an exploration of how the status quo is upheld, both by those who benefit from it and those who are too exhausted to fight it. Mm-hmm. And that the finale tied in directly with a very Mike Whiteian message, which is that certain people can't win ever in a world run by the man.
Mm-hmm. That or the women.
or in Connie.
Yeah, Connie. Don't forget how incredibly patriarchal that she is.
That she's patriarchal?
She's extremely patriarchal, yes.
That's a, yeah.
Extremely white patriarchal. I mean, the whole exchange I think her character has with, I'm trying to remember. Oh, I think it's with her. She was constantly butting heads with her daughter, who was a really fake woke person, but tried very hard in almost every single season. Totally. But yeah, to get back to Belinda, I think Natasha Rothwell is all of the things that you already said, that she's fantastic in it. And I think it's very understated and very complex. And I think that there was a moment where I was just like, oh, she's gonna give it to her. She's gonna give her the money. But then like I saw Jennifer Coolidge's character was super wrapped up in her own drama and just psychosis that I also was just like, oh yeah, that's how that would end for Melinda, sadly. And you know,
that totally feels like Jennifer Coolidge is never going to come through.
Yeah. Sweet as she is, but I think that's also Jennifer Coolidge is very good at playing this, somewhat empty, really nice, vindictive person. She carries all of those emotions, I think, quite well in this performance, and they're all contradicting each other.
She's an onion, as she likes to say.
There's
a line she has where she talks about like peeling to the heart of the onion. But so I guess you're not looking forward to season two because there's going to apparently be a season.
Yeah,
two.
There is going to be a season two. I enjoyed enough elements of the show to see where he will take some of the minimal criticism that he did receive from season one and how he will apply or not apply it to the second season. Because I think I am interested in the overall concept. The way in which he talks about the show is very... It's like, wow, I would like to see that show that you're talking about because I don't think that it was
effective.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, the way he's obviously very has strong feelings about Hawaiian colonialism and the way in which rich white people engage with it, especially in terms of like these touristy vacations. And the way in which he talks about all of that, I think, is very interesting. I didn't feel much of that in the show, though. It felt incomplete. And I don't know if there was like, I mean, I know that there was like restrictions in terms of the production amid COVID. Maybe it needed more episodes. Yes. Maybe. Because there was a lot that was incomplete. It was just kind of ended. I was just like, oh, so like all these other things were just going to just like not ever, we're not going to hear from these people anymore. Like in terms of like the people who just evaporate there, we're not going to see them again. We're not going to see really what happened to Kai. It just seemed like, oh, like these white characters don't care about these native Hawaiians, but I don't think that we are supposed to care about them. And that was really troubling to me because it didn't seem like the show really cared about them either. It's just like, who is it, a satire? Are you satirizing these characters or are you trying to get us to admit? Like, I don't know what was, it just seemed very strange to me, to say the least.
Well, that is, I think, at the heart of your piece and what we've seen tweeted. We'll see if Mike takes that feedback to heart and maybe gives us a deeper look at the, if it's an, it's upstairs, downstairs in Hawaii, part of me sort of feels like it's that we get, you know, part of the brilliancy of upstairs, downstairs was you really did get very deep. Okay. Most of the people listening to this probably were not alive when this series, it was like a BBC series or PBS series a bazillion years ago about upstairs, what would happen in the upstairs in a manor and the downstairs, the service staff, but it got very, very deep into the lives of the service staff as well. So, wow, did I just date myself or what? I think I just seriously did. Okay.
I'm familiar with this show.
No, you may be. Good. Good. That makes me feel so much
better.
I
haven't seen it, but I do.
It was on when I was a kid, honestly, but it was one of those water cooler shows that like everybody knew what it was about and it won a bazillion Emmys. I actually don't think I watched it. I was a kid at the time, but I know what it's about. You know, anyway, all right. Well, Candace, thank you so much for coming on the wrap up. For all of you who haven't seen The White Lotus and need to understand the different sides of the debate, go watch it or don't. Lots of great performances nonetheless. And Candace, thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.